Welcome to LBB's Open House, our podcast on how to build brands better. I'm Suchita. On the Open House podcast, I have candid conversations with founders, CXOs, and investors behind India's most compelling enterprises. As a co-founder of LBB, I love deep diving into all things marketing and distribution across different industries and learning from my guests. Today, I'm in conversation with Rohan Meerchandani. Before we get into this episode, just letting you all know that Open House is recorded as a live session. Make sure you check out LBB and sign up for our live chats where you can ask my guests questions in real time. Head over to the LBB app and search for Open House to sign up for the next one. So back to my guest. Rohan is a co-founder and CEO of Drums Food, the parent company of Epigamia. I'm sure you've seen their range of Greek yogurts, ghee spreads and smoothies on the shelves of your nearest trade store. Epigamia started out as an ice cream brand, and in our conversation, Rohan covers their pivot into Greek yogurt, finding product market fit, raising over $50 million, and also how they think about their target market. Rohan's passion and energy is palpable, and our conversation has plenty of real-life examples for all of us to learn from. Joining me this episode is my co-host and my colleague, Asa. You'll hear from her as well. Let's jump right into it. So Rohan, let's start with your story, man. How does a New Jersey boy land up in Bombay and sell Greek yogurt? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks, Suchita and the LBB team for having me. Super, super excited to do this with you guys and speak to it, to everybody. And, you know, always fun to share the story, even though it's a boring story for me, but I guess some people like it. So, I think you gave the intro perfectly. So I grew up in the United States. I had a little career in finance, and right before business school, which I graduated in 2012, I was actually out in India, looking at, this is back in 2011, 2010, looking at interesting opportunities, you know, what to do, what not to do. Back then it wasn't as exciting. 2011 is when we had sort of the peak of all the crises and, you know, government scandals. But I had a really, really good friend out there in Bombay. We explored a whole bunch of options. I never saw myself living in India, but I thought it was intriguing. I also had went through that little bit of what they call the ABCD crisis, if anyone has ever heard of that. American born, confused Desi, and sort of wanted to connect with my roots. But ended up actually not doing anything sort of professionally, except I ended up investing in this company, which I am the CEO of now. Our first sort of avatar or version 1.0 for us was a brand called Hokey Pokey Ice Cream, if any of you ever remember that. In fact, that's how we connected, if you remember. Yeah. And that sort of is how our journey started. My involvement at that time was purely just from an investor perspective. I came back to the United States, went to Philadelphia, finished graduation, and honestly was going to pursue a career back in finance, which is what I thought was I was good at. It was my calling. But honestly, I just never, ever had a desire to be in that corporate world. I mean, I think my DNA, my blood breeds sort of, hustle and ground floor entrepreneurship. I love the grind. I still do. I can't live without it. I don't know. My title is CEO. I don't know what that means. I'm still trying to figure that out. But long story short, while I was in business school, I took a class called Marketing to the Indian Consumer, where I came out to India in December 2011, I remember very clearly. And I came to do two things. One is to go check out this sort of ice cream, a few ice cream shops that we had invested in and launched, and which had a great product, at least I believe so, had a loyal following. But we just found that the business model was paying rent to the landlords. You know, we weren't able to make any money out of it. And I came to sort of just review with the team that do we need to really continue this? And, you know, I was only a partial shareholder and other shareholders as well. Or do we just shut it down? And I think I took a class, like I said, and one of my teachers, guest lecturers, was a gentleman who was the former CMO of Coca-Cola India. And he just talked about the advent, and we're going to touch upon this today, but back in 2011, the advent of consumer brands and, you know, the next 15, 20 years ahead. Pretty much, I guess, what Govel would have covered with you last time, you know, his Govel's thesis, which came to light. And I actually met Govel through this gentleman. Back then, which is only 9 years ago, you had any grocery shop you went to or any Kirana shop you went to, pretty much 99% of the products you saw were controlled by 9 companies you could count on your fingers. You know, the big guys, as everyone knows. I had sort of a ghante bajge eureka moment, you know, that there was an opportunity here to build a consumer brand that would not just be disruptive, but also stand the test of time. And of course, during this time, you had a global movement in sort of the big, forgive my language, but the FU startups around the world that said FU to the big guys. And that movement hadn't come to India yet, but it was on its way. And I think, you know, a lot of credit is owed to my dear friend Neeraj at Paperboat for leading that revolution in India to kickstart the FMCG sort of revolution. And I think I just had a calling, so went back to the United States, finished school, against every recommendation of every friend, family, uncle, auntie, cha-cha, chachi, who said, you're out of your mind for coming to India. You're this, ABCD who thinks they can operate in this country where many have failed. But I think my thought process was, it's something I had to do for myself. It wasn't anyone else's decision. So 2013 took a one-way ticket, and I haven't looked back since, until now. Well, I've been stuck in this basement in Delaware the last 3 months.
So, your journey is fascinating. And I remember Hokey Pokey, Hoskas Village is where you guys had sort of opened up in Delhi. And you guys had this model of like Cold Stone. And then you had done your packaged ice creams. And your ice creams were actually fantastic. But, like you said, you've obviously gone through many iterations, right? So from an ice cream company to Greek yogurt, now you're sort of diversifying your offering even under the umbrella of Epigamia. Could you talk a little bit about, what does it take to find product market fit? And what was your sort of view on the market? Because the ice cream customer and the Greek yogurt customer, I would assume, are dramatically different in terms of, the use case of the product, right? Yeah. So could you talk a little bit about, your initial couple of years, what did it take for you to find product market fit? And also, in your opinion, what does product market fit look like?
Yeah. So I think I'll just preempt that what you just said. So I wouldn't say the target consumer is different. I think the use case or the occasion is different, right? I think that's a big sort of clarification. So I'll answer this in two parts, Suchita. I think the first part being the product side. Let's focus on that a little bit. But secondly, I think also sort of just philosophy, and I'm sure something that everyone here has heard many times. I think we're a good classic case study on maybe how you can approach it. Is this whole fail fast mentality, right? And as much as, I don't know if we have any friends from the big guys here, but as much as they'll tell you, there's research and you can do an analysis and you can quantify it. I'm sorry, at our level, you can't quantify shit. You have to poke your finger in the fire. The key is, how fast can you pull it back out, just to see what's next. And I think that's the reality and the journey that we went through. I think the first rule is, and then I'll sort of frame this in terms of our journey. That's all I can really tell you is what we did. We're not experts, but I can just tell you what we did. And I think our sort of first entry, like I mentioned, was these ice cream parlors. And you said you've been to Hoskas. And, if you look at it, the journey actually started with starting this. It was a local chef that I met, who is my co-founder as well now, who had this idea to set up a dessert lounge. And I invested and convinced him, to sort of look at doing a Cold Stone Creamery type concept, which was a huge rage in the United States back then. I was a big consumer myself. And honestly, I'd be very open and candid. There was absolutely no vision, no business plan. There was no sort of, oh my God, this is what we're going to do now. This is what we're going to do now. And anyone, again, any entrepreneur that tells you they know what they're doing is talking, gibberish. The reality is, how fast can you move? How fast can you adapt? And how fast can you learn? Take the insights. The first insight for us in that, and of course I wasn't in India at the time, but the first insight that we saw through this journey, as I mentioned to you, was our basic business model was to collect money to create this amazing experience and then take all that money and give it to the landlord who owned the property. It absolutely had nothing left in between for us. As you remember, rightfully so, that Hoskas Village is a fantastic location. We used to get amazing crowds. But it was a pretty fancy, expensive rent. And then you're also restricted to the product type, which is an evening product that you eat, late night. It's not an all day consumption. It's not an all week consumption. That was one insight that came from it. Secondly, I think what we also realized is there was a larger sort of opportunity in FMCG, which is on the package side, more so than just the parlors, because the parlors being brick and mortar required a lot of different types of scale. In terms of, I've got these two sons of mine running around. So just excuse me on that. It's 7:30 in the morning here in case they come into the screen. No. And everyone's been going through that. So it's not just me. I think the other thing we sort of realized is, the parlor business, the brick and mortar side of it was not very scalable, required a lot of capital. That's around the time I'd actually met Kaval and had some great conversations. He was still at Helion at the time and was building out his thesis for what a consumer fund would look like. I still remember those conversations. And now look at what happened with Fireside. It's amazing. The reality was, we said there was, that while the parlors were good for brand building, you know, it wasn't scalable in terms of, you know, setting up 1,000 parlors all over the country, managing the system's operations. And I think QSR still has been a bit of a challenge in India in general, across the board. So the first step was, okay, you know, to scale CPG, FMCG makes sense, packaged product. So we took our best-selling sort of creations off of Cold Stone and then packaged them, and then got into, what I call Hokey Pokey 2.0, which was our FMCG product. And that actually helped us really build out, you know, a decent sort of FMCG practice. And in the initial terms, you know, there was just crazy buzz because we had created a lot of noise, you know, at places like House Class Village, at places like Carter Road and Bandra. And when I first moved to India, the first step for us was to get into sort of the FMCG side of it. In the beginning, we had a bull rush. We got extremely cocky. We thought we were kings, just because it was innovative. It was a new product line. It was something that I guess there was a little bit of a demand for. So just sort of quality, locally sourced, locally made ice cream. And I remember there was an article that came out on a very well-known blog that called us India's answer to Ben and Jerry's, and I think that was a great arrival for us, and it helped sort of tame sort of the culture and the breeding ground, you know, for the company and the excitement. But we sort of, you know, got humbled very quickly, because while we had an amazing run and, you know, revenues, I mean, went up like 400% in just a year. We faced what was the first season, and FMCG guys will tell you, especially for things like beverages, soft drinks, and ice cream, the entire 95% of the sale for the year happens in 2 or 3 months, you know, which is unfortunately what we're in right now. So that's another issue. We'll get into COVID later on, I guess. Mm-hmm. And essentially ice cream was even more seasonal. And, you know, we, coming from a country where, or a city in New York, where you've got, you know, crazy winters and crazy summers, I really didn't know what seasonality meant. I thought India is hot all year round, you know, typical sort of, you know, guy not from India, trying to push his views or think or make assumptions. And the reality was, we had this amazing run, May, I remember very clearly May of 2015, just amazing sales. And then all of a sudden, you know, monsoon hit and revenues became 20% of what they were. And, you know, we had put all these nice projections in for investors that were going to double and triple and the usual, what we've all seen and gone through. And all of a sudden we just got chopped down to size. And I think that's where the reality kicked in that, okay, this was nice. We got off to a good start. You know, the first innings were, the first overs were pretty reasonable. I have to start saying overs now. But now, you know, we need to stabilize and what next, you know, as we get to, you know, further let down the game. And I think that's where a lot of insight came from, coming back to your question earlier, is the consumers that we used to have at the parlors. Now, you know, me being a very scrappy entrepreneur, you know, I was that creepy guy that would live at the parlors, have conversations, talk to the consumers till there was no end, until they were like, all right, dude, leave us alone. But I did have free ice cream.
We've all done that. If it
okay,
means
exactly.
Better, we've all done that.
Exactly. So the good thing is I had free ice cream to offer in return. So I was able to catch consumers. So had a lot of good conversations. And I think one of the insights that came from there, this is coming back to your earlier question about the consumer. And obviously, I think more importantly, the occasion. And one of the insights was there was this sort of movement towards healthier eating. We also learned that, you know, a lot of consumers were looking to Hokey Pokey as a cheat meal. And the cheat meal was not something that was happening twice a month or thrice a month. It wasn't something that we were able to push or even want to push on a daily basis. Yes, you know, we used the purest of ingredients. We were no preservatives. But at the end of the day, it was a cheat meal. It was ice cream. And I think, you know, we also sort of, so one, that was one big insight. The other big insight was this whole seasonality thing, right? That to sort of sustain the season, you had to come up with a very different, and a lot of ice cream players had different business models where during season, they went all out. They took on a lot of temporary staff. They went into catering, wedding events, which we also tried our hands at. But it was a very different business model because off season, literally everyone just goes quiet. And that was hard for us to do when you're a startup trying to build scale, right? You're trying to expand distribution. And the Kirana shop is telling you, "Saab, abhi season mail, abhi nahi dekhne gaye." You know, like, abhi aap season mail. And how do you sort of, in this finite period of 3 or 4 months, build a practice, build a business, and then also expand distribution? It was tough. So essentially what we realized is, okay, we've got a decent product. It has a fit in terms of the consumer. We've been able to build a large consumer base, but we haven't been able to derive the kind of revenue we want out of that consumer base. And secondly, seasonality is playing a big role, you know, in terms of how we can scale this. So what we thought we could do in 4 or 5 years is going to take us 15 years. And then third, you know, this sort of trend around healthy eating, healthy lifestyles. Even though I still think that's no one really knows what that means. It's very subjective. The other sort of big thing that came around was, you know, the idea around when I say healthy eating, you know, we did a whole sort of survey and research and obviously these creepy conversations at the parlors around what it really means. What does that mean to you? And what we realized is that there wasn't anyone who said, I don't think about healthy eating. You know, whether it was someone who's super fit and lean like yourself, Suchita, or someone a little heavier like me, or even heavier like my co-founders. You know, everyone said they were doing the right thing, that they were approaching it the right way. The question was, you know, what's right, what's wrong? And, you know, back then, you know, carbs were the enemy. Fat was the enemy. Then carbs became the enemy. Then fat became good for you. Now we've got an intermittent fasting, you know, and this is just a never ending cycle of what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. And I still don't think there's a clear cut answer, you know, on what is right, what is wrong. You know, now there's conversations. Now the big conversation is immunity. You know, if I'm eating this, what kind of immunity is this food giving me? And again, you know, there's mom's tales from haldi and turmeric, even though there's beliefs in that. But there's also science. And I think there's just a lot of confusion. And that confusion has just gotten even worse, you know, thanks to COVID. What we did sort of derive, which was an India-centric thing, is this hardcore, you know, focus on no preservative, preservative-free sort of eating, and there was this link towards freshness, you know, maka ghar ka khana, fresh eating at home, and that's what I think what we really sort of that's a trend that we really sort of tackled, jumped on, and said, okay. You know, taking all these learnings, the three that I just mentioned, aside from the fact that from a product perspective, we had some you know, know-how of dairy products, dairy sourcing, and the fact that I was a huge Greek yogurt fan and consumer back home in the United States, just sort of took all of this together and did what I call through a better dart, which I think entrepreneurs have to do is just keep throwing darts. So I know that was a long answer, but I tried to cover a little broad, you know, spectrum of how we went about it.
So just a question there, and I know my colleague Asa has one too, but why Greek yogurt, right? And the reason I'm asking that is because to a layperson, it just sounds like a fancier version of saying yogurt, right? Why not take the dahi angle, but, you know, do like hipster cool dahi. So why Greek yogurt? You know, did the model then become let's bring Chibani to India? What was the thought process there?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, Greek yogurt, and I'll be openly honest and admitted, is a bit of a farce because it doesn't really exist. It was a branding tool used by the Americans, basically. The Greeks till today are like, what are you talking about? Yeah, like, what is it that you're referring to? You know, it's very interesting you asked that question, and I'll talk about the journey. So, I think it became a branded tool out there where there was this sort of illusion or illusion, if you may call it, that Greek yogurt was healthy and it's healthier, it's better, whatever it is. The reality was it was just this, you know, form of making a strained yogurt, which is essentially taking dahi and removing the pani and straining it. Now, believe it or not, we've been doing it in India for hundreds of years. We just refer to it as Shrikhand or chakka, you know, and basically we became a lower sugar form of Shrikhand. Now, we actually did some testing to say, should we call it you know, dahi on steroids, or even look at a modern version of Shrikhand. But that became our brand positioning, which is a contemporary take on this very, you know, sort of traditional industry. But from a brand perspective and from a messaging perspective and from a narrative perspective, you know, Greek yogurt was a global phenomenon, and we felt that was the right language to sort of communicate with. That being said, we did do a big sort of focus group about 2 years, 3 years ago, and we sort of classified our consumers into what we called you know, the give a shit consumer and the don't give a shit consumer. And I would still be very, and I'll say this proudly. I still know that a large base of our consumers have no clue what Greek yogurt even means, and nor do they care. It just sort of was enough to evoke interest and say, oh, okay. You know, if we Google Greek yogurt, it has some healthy benefits. And I think in this sort of larger world, and I'll talk about this in a second, in this larger world of healthy eating, what's sort of critical is permissibility. And I'll come back to that. I think you probably have more questions around it. Is, you know, convincing yourself what I'm doing is right, and just getting a checkbox that's saying, okay, there's something out there that's telling me this is good for me. Because honestly, how much time do we have to really focus and think? And there's a dearth of information, and not just information, opposing information. You know, we can find 100 articles that tell me chocolate's good for me, wine's good for me, whiskey is good for me, and we'll find 1,000 articles that are telling you it's not good for you. I'll find 1,000 articles telling you ice cream's got calcium and it's rich and it's got, you know, good dairy, and there's 1,000 articles telling you where it's horrible for you. So it's never ending, you know, and I think that's where that sort of comes from.
Got it. And related to that, so I know the name is one thing, right? But I think the second question that I had was also around your supply chain and cold storage and just transportation and logistics, right? It's not like you evaded those problems by picking a category like Greek yogurt.
Yeah, we actually made it tougher for ourselves. Yeah.
Exactly. So why that? Because you know, very, very tough category to crack. Infrastructure has only recently started developing in a way where, you know, your FedEx and the likes provide you with cold storage, you know, and it would be great to learn a little bit about what you've done at your end to crack that problem. So could you get into the logistics and the supply chain side of like why Greek yogurt and why did you pick one of the toughest categories that is there, that is out there to crack?
Yeah, so I think, aside from we just love picking the toughest categories, that's another nuance about our company. We just love problems. I think the reality is the cold chain, which by the way, there are players, but there are more service providers that help. They still can't execute and manage. And it's still a very broken system. Today, you know, we're probably, if not, at least not in the South, but at least in Mumbai and maybe parts of Delhi, we're probably one of the largest direct distributors of cold chain, of refrigerated products. We've been approached by many to do their distribution for them. And not only was it something that we had to tackle because it didn't exist. So I think that's the first question. You know, when we went about it, so the first sort of coming from the consumer side, which is the last conversation we just had, fresh was a big theme that came out, that people wanted to eat fresh products. One of the mistrusts for FMCG was, if this can sit at home with me for 2 years, you know, what's in it? You know, if this can sit, you know, in my house in the heat for a year, what's inside it? You know, kya dala isme? And I think that became a big question. And I think that's something we came out to address, is that there was no one sort of disrupting the fresh space, right? And that was key on the consumer side. Now, you can disrupt it because there's obviously a clear-cut demand, but the demand is also existing because no one's figured out this obscene supply chain, which is very expensive and not easy to create. And, you know, we worked first with talking to numerous distributors, trying to understand, you know, how can we crack the code on the distribution side? But we just learned that the distributors were just not helpful. You know, they wanted to work with just very large sort of risk-free businesses like the Amuls and the Mother Dairies. And they had no desire to work with us. And the ones that had, you know, even wanted to try us out was because maybe they had someone in their team that pushed for us, maybe a son or a daughter. And that was a very small lasting relationship. They wouldn't pay us and things like that. And then we realized that if we really want to do this the right way, and also from our own perspective, which helped with Hokey Pokey, is develop those relationships directly with the retailers. You know, I've gone door to door, step by step, to every kirana shop and said, you know, sab aap kaam rakho, maal rakho, bikega, main aapko promise karta hoon, bikega. And I think we realized that we had to sort of do this ourselves. And not only did we do it ourselves, I think coming back to your question, the massive challenge also was not just a challenge, it presented an opportunity if we could crack the code. Mm-hmm. So we actually, a lot of our investment went towards building the cold chain. A lot of people think it was towards the brand. The brand was actually not a big part of our investment and the money we've raised. It's all, bulk of it has been towards building our own sort of sustainable cold chain and just building systems and processes. And while I don't think anything we're doing is some super, super rocket science cutting edge technology, I think it's just been our rigorous focus on execution and hustle that's been able to sort of get us, you know, how many stores can you deliver in a day? How much time can you spend per every delivery? Can you optimize, you know, the space on the shelves? Just simple stuff that we've just been really religious about. And that's not only become sort of our not only were we able to crack it, it's become a core competence. You know, today, if someone was to ask me, what is your business model? I would say cold chain distribution, more so than anything else.
Got it. Asa, you have a question.
Yeah, I think it's the halfway mark. So I think it's a good time to steer it towards branding and pricing.
Sure.
Just like, you know, your thoughts on, actually, my favorite question, how did Epigamia as a name come up?
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
Could you talk a little bit about the name Epigamia, how you came up with the branding, and also, you know, just process behind getting the brand out, right? So maybe your year 0 to 1 of getting Epigamia off the ground.
Yeah. So I think, you know, this is obviously a story I love telling. So we'll get into the brand itself and you know, Epigamia, and where the hell did he get that name from, and what does it even mean? You know, so while we were doing Hokey Pokey, there was a lot of sort of conversations around brand. And, you know, the first question was, when we launched this sort of complementary product, which, by the way, was supposed to be a compliment. It wasn't supposed to dominate and hog all the attention, which it ended up doing eventually. The idea was, you know, why not just launch it under the same brand name? But the thought process was that, you know, from the insights we derived, which I just told you about earlier, the healthy eating trends, the lifestyle trends, we realized that Hokey Pokey still had a very, you know, cheat meal terminology associated with it. We wanted a brand that could sort of stand a little bit more for lifestyle and beliefs and philosophy. And therein sort of came in, you know, a lot of recommendation around, you know, some of the most successful brands have been linked to stories around the founder, you know, and what the founder's beliefs are. So now I'm going to bore you guys for a minute. So everyone on, just bear with me, you know, just stay with me for the next minute. So if we go back to our history books, so we go back to 500 sort of BC, you know, so I'm going way back in time, you know, think back to your school days, if you paid attention. You know, we had Chandragupta Maurya was the emperor of India, with the Mauryan Empire in India. And on the European side, you have the Macedonian Greek Empire, which was led by Alexander the Great. There's actually a series now on television about you know, when the Greek army had come to India. And in our sort of language, we call them Sikandar. That's where the name came from, when Alexander the Great and his armies came to India. So you have the Mauryan sort of Indians, and you had the Macedonian Greeks, and the Greeks had crossed all of Persia, Afghanistan, and reached the Indian side. And there was a war that was fought between the two sides. It's the first ever documented conflict between Eastern and Western civilization in history. And the war ended with two different narratives, two different histories, which continue till today. The European side seems to think that, you know, Alexander the Great got tired and his armies got tired and they came back. Our side seems to think that we beat the shit out of them and won the war, which I think is probably more the truth. But the reality was that first ever documented conflict between Eastern and Western civilizations ended in a peace treaty. And that peace treaty was the first ever documented peace treaty between Eastern and Western civilization. And that peace treaty was predicated on an ancient Greek term called epigamia, which meant marriage of civilizations. You know, so blending and marriage of civilizations. If you look at me, you know, you can see this very common looking face you would see in India, but he's got this American accent. So I consider myself a blend of two civilizations. I consider our products a blend of two civilizations. Indian in their DNA. Everything is made in India, sourced in India, and even following a lot of Indian tradition in terms of chakka or shrikhand, or if you look at our Greek yogurt smoothies, lassi. But it brings this sort of global thinking, global mindset, and global quality, which we want to set out to prove. So many people for the first 6 to 8 months, I'd say even up to a year, and even now, thought that we're an imported product, which to me is sort of an insult, right? Like, why can't we? I mean, this is made in India. What's your problem? You know, why does this have to be import to be good? And we went through this journey, and now, of course, there's this big talk about it, but we even sort of helped coin this term "global," you know, globally, global thinking, locally, locally made, locally sourced. And we set out when we did this sort of range to say that not only can we make this here, not only do we have some of the best, you know, milk, or it just, you need to reach the source. The problem is a lot of it has adulteration issues and challenges when it reaches through the supply chain. We have some of the best fruit. Some of our best mangoes don't even come to us in India. They go to Dubai, which is just really sad. So we said, why can't we source some of that best stuff? Make this here locally, and whatever we make should be able to stand up on the shelves anywhere in the world, which we think it can. And we've actually proven that recently by, you know, getting some orders from the Middle East and putting our products up there. And that was sort of the thought process around the brand. I know I've given a long answer, but, you know, sort of the brand standing for sort of our philosophy, the founder's mentality, as well as something that, you know, we think can really resonate. Also, I just love, you know, mind twisters, and Epigamia is a brand. You know, everyone asks me what's the right way to pronounce it, and I say whatever your mind fancies. You know, the largest selling candy confectionery in India today is Alpenlibe Butterscotch, and people don't even can just mispronounce that name all the time. So we're very happy. So if there's a question coming up, there is absolutely no right way to pronounce it. Whatever you fancy, epigamia, epigamia, you know, feel free to call it what you want.
What about your price point? Because, you know, even in our conversation with Kaval, right, that came up a fair amount where pricing plays such a big role in demand generation, and not just demand generation, but your whole infra is based on what you price your commodity at, right?
Yeah.
Epigamia obviously isn't the cheapest yogurt, you know, or dahi that's out there. How did you, you know, in your year 0 to 1, 0 to 3, how did you crack pricing? Because there are a lot of, you know, young entrepreneurs on this call. And I think that that's one struggle that you always have, right? Without GTM, what should my pricing be? So could you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah. So I mean, this is the ever evolving conversation with Kaval as well. You know, I think, so from my perspective, I'm more than convinced that, you know, we think of India as a very price sensitive market. I do not believe that at all. I think it's an extremely value conscious market. The very fact that a company like Audi has done well, you know, actually goes to show that quality and engineering, and there's an, you know, so what is the Indian mentality? Indian mentality is I have to spend less on servicing this car because it's such a good quality, you know, because the engine's good. Of course, the brand has a lot of legs and all that, you know, is separate. But, you know, if we look at sort of the way I look at it, and it's a very sort of, you know, basic, simplistic rule. The way I see it is Indians have a very suspicious nature as to why the price is what it is. So the immediate reaction, especially for food, is to say, what would it cost me if I was to make this myself? You know, if I sit at home and decode this, you know, what would it cost me? So if it's a, you know, simple thing like a juice or something, if I take an orange and put it into my blender or try to make it myself, what would it cost me? So what am I paying outside? And I think that's where we actually have narratives around this. So if you look at our product, if you just compare it with the plain dahi, we're a little more expensive, right? Now, if you take our Greek yogurt, if you take the dahi and convert it into a Greek yogurt, which means for every 3 cups of dahi, it takes to make 1 Greek yogurt because you have to strain it, you have to remove all the water, you have to strain it in a muslin cloth like a cheese. And then you have to add, obviously, the great quality of it, et cetera, et cetera. Then if you start decoding it at home, it's like, okay, it'll cost me a little bit more to make this at home than what it's buying from these guys. And I think that's a really important narrative. I'm not from the school of thought, and I don't believe, and I think it's nonsense that, you know, create a good quality brand and spend on advertising and people will buy it just because you've created a good brand. Hogwash. I think there has to be some substance behind it. You know, the days, at least now we're seeing very clearly the old days of the 80s and early 90s when you could just, the big guys would just put an amazing ad out there and people would just lap it up. You could probably get a good surge in the beginning, but the quality has to sustain itself for, you know, sort of consumer retention and loyalty. And I think, you know, that's where I think we sort of cracked the code a little bit, you know, where if you look at our product, the narrative was it takes 3 cups of dahi, it takes fresh mangoes, combine all of it. And by all means, we actually started giving recipes out there on how you can make Greek yogurt at home, which is kind of an oxymoron if you think about it. Why would a brand tell you how to make their product at home? We did it on purpose because we said, if you try doing it, you'll see the value proposition that we bring to the table. Hmm. You know, things like having fresh mangoes that we actually get from Goa, a lot of them, which get exported to Dubai, we actually got the farmer and sourced it from him. Our mangoes, people love. They said, "Isme asli aam ka flavor aa raha hai." You know, so there's a lot of nuances that go into it. But I think at the end of the day, my advice to fellow entrepreneurs would be, you know, crack the code on defining to your consumers what the narrative is around the value you're proposing. You know, and the value, don't tell me the brand is the value. That's hogwash. The brand gets created. You can't just tell me because I have a brand, they're going to pay more. Bullshit. That's not the way it works. Your brand will get created because you propose a value. Yeah, you may do all the innovative stuff on social media and get awareness and all of that, but sustainability is going to come from value creation. And that's really what I'm convinced that we've got a very immense, you know, sort of value market. It's not a sensitive market. It's a value market. But value has to be demonstrated, defined, and then created in terms of pricing.
So speaking of value, right, obviously the most important metric for you would be sales. But when you talk about things like
profitability.
Oops, continue. Sorry. We're all about that profit. No, so profitability is one, you know, sales is the other. When you think of things like this, right, when you think of metrics that help you donate, you know, determine the value that you're creating for the customer, What does your MIS look like? What are you tracking? Or what is your call to command when it comes to the teams that you work with? What is everyone optimizing for?
Simply, it's not a rocket science business. It's expand distribution. So what are your KPIs around that? And secondly, and most importantly, which a lot of people forget in our space at least, is you think let's expand distribution, which is kind of in your space, acquire consumers. How many can you get? But then what are you doing about retention? You know, what are you doing about, for us, retention in your world, in our world, is called same store sales growth. That first Kirana shop I got, or the 15th one I got, or the 100th one I got, what are they doing? I've gone from 100 to 10,000, or now we're closer to 15,000 now. So you had an old data point there. But, what's happening to number one and number 100 and number 200 and number 300? So from a KPI perspective, it's actually not that different. But from a sort of strategy perspective, it's clear cut. Yes, my sales are doubling and tripling and quadrupling. But is it only because of the expanding distribution? Or are those initial consumers buying more and more and more? And by initial consumers, for us, it's the shops. But then also going a little bit deeper and saying beyond the shops, who are the people that are going there? And what more are we doing to make sure they're buying more? And that we're capturing the consumer in its sort of life cycle journey. Now, it's a little bit harder in our world, and I'll come to it in a second. We're talking about disruption and pivoting and sort of adapting with the market. For us, a big adaptation for this COVID world has been doing something that I would have never imagined for the life of me, is we're now doing direct to consumer. And we were pushed to doing it. And we did it because, consumers were yelling and screaming that I'm sitting at home and locked up and not able to get your product. But you guys have essential passes to service. You're a Kirana shop. What if I give you a similar order like a Kirana shop? Will you deliver it to me? And it started off with just simply a demand, which is maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago. And now, it's something that's giving us 500 orders a day. And we're saying, okay, this can become a channel for us. But I think the reality is, again, these are those consumers that have been buying us for some time. And we're just making sure that we don't lose them. And in our journey, it's called, like I said, same store sales growth. And I think, in the sort of larger tech world, customer retention or customer. But I think it's really the same thing. It's the same metric, right? So how are you expanding distribution? How are you getting more customers? And how are you, retaining your current customers, which is same store sales growth? And I think that's simply, it's a very simple philosophy and easy for us to track.
And what about NPS, right? How are you sort of tracking, just customer feedback? So of course, store growth is one imperative indicator. But have you guys, worked on any tools that help you actually capture what is the customer thinking about that product? Because your distributor is third party, right? Your distributor is not you.
Well, right now the distributor is us. We're directly supplying. But yes, the retailer is a third party. So where it off takes from, absolutely, where you buy it from. Absolutely. So we do a bunch of consumer surveys. We get a lot of insight from there. But honestly, I think, at the end of the day, I actually spoke at a Unilever conference about a year and a half ago, and it was very interesting. And I was asked this question, and it was actually with the entire marketing, R&D, and innovation team. I wonder if anyone from that team is on here today. I wouldn't be surprised. And I remember, it was a good presentation. And, I think someone asked about sort of not promoter score, but we actually talked about new product development. And I'll tell you why it's tied. And they said, how do you guys go about it? And what makes you sort of do this? So I said, look, we have a very simple philosophy. Move as fast as you can. Put the product on the shelf as fast as you can. Fail it as fast as you can and remove it. And I said, by the time you guys get a research report, get a Nielsen report, pay for it, get your approvals to pay for it. Finally, Nielsen charges you an arm and a leg. You guys receive it. By the time you do all of that, we have already launched the product, figured out if it works or not, and removed it or iterated. And literally everyone there just like had their jaws open. They're like, wow, that's our life problem. It takes us a year to actually get the research right. And I think from our perspective, I'm not saying I'm a big believer in consumer data, and obviously with D2C, we've gotten some amazing data, but I don't think one needs to overthink it at our phase. I think maybe when you become a 5, 7, 8,000 crore company, then there's a different conversation to be had. But at our phase, I think it's very important to just get some core users on some kind of platform with communication. So whether that's a loyalty program, whether that's a reach out program, and we've got this sort of cohort of 200-300 consumers that we're constantly talking to, right? And we think they form a good cohort that's representative of the larger pool. And getting, whether it's obviously for them, it's fun because we keep giving them freebies. We call them for conversations, focus groups, as you may, even though I hate that word, And I just think it's a tasting. I like the word tasting better. Getting candid feedback. So just sort of having those conversations. And then from an NPS perspective, I mean, we've done some exercises, but honestly, Suchita, it's been more for pleasing investors and making them feel like, okay, there's some science involved here. It's not been for our own sake because we've not made, I mean, we know what our competitors are doing. We know why they're selecting us over the others. You know, we've got a good sort of idea. Putting a net promoter score for a board meeting to please them, we do it. But I can very honestly tell you it's for them. It's not for us. We're not doing anything with that information. I think what's important is, what's that?
Hat tip for the honesty.
Yeah. Okay. I think the reality for us is one of our core values is brutal honesty. And I think if we're not brutally honest with each other, I'm very honest with our investors too. I said, this is for you, not for us.
I think it's really interesting because Kawaljeet also mentioned this point when I asked him about failures, and he said, you know, no, I don't want to talk about failures at Fireside, but yes, we've had learning.
Yeah.
And one of the learnings he mentioned was about Hokey Pokey turning into Epigamia.
Yep, yep.
What you took the guys at the conference through, right, that you've put out a product, you've learned from the mistakes, and you've said it's working, not working. Can you take us through one example of that?
Yeah, so I think A, as we talked about, right, I think the seasonality that I covered was a big issue with FMCG and with ice cream. And I think, you know, the immediate thought process was, you know, what more can we do? Can we keep putting more thoughts around this? Can we convince people to eat ice cream in the monsoons, right? And that's the initial, that's always the thing, right? And by the way, everyone out there, if you love your product, and if you don't, that's some negative thing. I love my products. I loved Hokey Pokey. I still love Hokey Pokey, and we may bring it back. We'll have LBB make the announcement for us eventually, but it is going to come back. The question is, at some point though, you have to look at it and say, does this make sense? You know, am I really putting the wrong resources or bad resources after the wrong things? So the initial thought process is, okay, this is the problem. It's a seasonality issue, right? And I'm sort of giving you a little bit of a mini case study. So it's a seasonality issue. We've realized that the business plan is going to take 15 years, not 5 years. And we have to go about this differently. So there's two solutions. Solution A is keep trying to get that product out there and put it into different occasions. So ice cream in the rain. Why are people not eating ice cream in monsoon? Because there's this notion that gala kharab ho jata, you know, you get sick in the rain if you eat ice cream, which is, again, hogwash, by the way. It has nothing to do with the rain. We can discuss that a separate day. it's about how germs are collected in a fragmented and a misused supply chain, but that's a different story for a different day. But the reality is that's a massive endeavor, right, to convince people and change habits. But it's not something that people haven't done. People can change habits. Or do you say, you know what? Let's park that for a second. We know there's a seasonality issue. We've developed a little bit of a distribution. The retailers love us. They're happy to put more products of ours on the shelf. We've created this value. How about we unlock it through a new product that people would want to consume in the monsoon, not to convince them to do something different, and capitalize on these trends and things of that nature. So I think there's a lot of decisions we face. And sometimes we have to sort of, you know, look at a little bit of humility and say, yes, this product is awesome. But dude, it's not going to sell in the freaking monsoon, you know, move on. and I think that's the sort of conversation one has to have when you're looking at, you know, pivot or adaptation or moving fast or resilience or whatever you want to call it.
Got it. So I have like a bajillion questions for you, but I think the one question that actually just came up on the chat as well, everyone wants to know, how the hell did you raise over $50 million? because it's super tough, you know, especially if you're in the FMCG space, if you're not a tech product, there aren't even enough diverse pools of capital to, you know, tap into. Kaval is one firm, and now we've obviously got more coming up in the form of A91, etc. But could you talk a little bit about, I understand you may have needed the fundraise to create that infra, that, you know, cold chain, etc. But could you talk a little bit about why did you raise money? How did you get to that $50 million raise? And how is it really having a strategic as an investor in your company?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to chat. And I think, again, I can talk about, you know, the sort of the learning and what we went through. And I think I'm very openly, and I see we've got almost 94 participants, which is awesome. And I hope many of you are entrepreneurs. I actually gave a full sort of workshop, like an hour and a half on our, they asked me to teach people how to fundraise. And I said, I still don't know how to fundraise. I can just tell you what we did, right? And I think the reality is it was no different from what many of you out there have gone through, right? We've got, I can probably share, I have a couple of slides I should have brought up, you know, every rejection email we've gotten. You know, this isn't for us. It's not the right time. You're too small. And then it became, oh, you're too big. Like, okay, what happened in between? So, you know, we've gone through all of it, right? I think the reality was, you know, for us, you know, A, being resilient and making sure we had to sort of get out there. We knew what we needed to scale. Why? So let's start with why. So why raise capital? I think, you know, very clearly, this kind of business that we wanted to do, and which was the North Star. The North Star was create a brand that stands the test of time, right? Something that's going to be long gone after I'm off planet Earth or my team's off planet Earth. You need capital, right? It's very clear. And it's not just capital to, for a brand side of it, but I think we realized very early on we had to build this supply chain and we needed capital for that. And building that supply chain was what would give us our moat or our competitive edge or cutting edge or whatnot or competition, you know, to beat competition. I think we had some very interesting conversations in the journey where, you know, we were just brutally honest with every investor. You know, we never sort of beat around the bush. Of course, we had fancy projections. Who doesn't? You have to. But honestly, I can tell you right now, none of those projections come true. Everyone knows that. And every investor knows that. I think, but it was good to sort of open up and not try to have a conversation just to close a fundraise. It was good to open up and have conversation around the thought process, the thinking, their thinking, our thinking. And I think as we went further and further in the journey, I remember, you know, maybe the first 10 or 12 investors that rejected us, and there were many, by the way. So not a good piece of news. Keep it up, everyone out there. You know, it was almost like we were trying to make them hear what they wanted to hear. We started adapting our pitches and our conversations. And honestly, the first conversation where I just spoke my mind and ended up doing what I wanted to do, I got money. you know, whether it was Koval was an early angel. So, we always talk about Koval. So Koval has two funds now, Fireside One and Fireside Two, which he may have talked about. But we're actually from Fireside Zero, which was the first fund, which was his personal trust. And it was his own money. So our investor is Fireside, but it's actually Koval's own sort of, you know, money that came into us in the beginning. And aside from him, even people like, you know, we met DSG, Deepak Shadatpuri, DSG Consumer Partners. And again, it was, you know, just being open and honest, brutally honest about what we wanted to do. And I think that's where that clicked really well. The other thing I will say is, you know, we took a conscious decision early on. And we had, you know, at some point, once things started to work out the right way, we thought fast, we moved on. And I think a lot of these investors, actually all of them didn't come in immediately in the beginning. They all watched us, right? That's another thing. There were conversations, they watched us, we were able to demonstrate what we were able to prove. And once we got to some scale, they got excited and came on board. I think the other big conversation, you know, sort of was around who do you go with? And at some point when we got that scale, you know, we'd raised some angel capital, or as I call the FFF, the Friends, Family, Fools. You know, we got to a certain point when, you know, we had options where we had 3-4 different investors that we wanted to bring on board. And I think, I know it's a fact, we actually took a massive haircut, you know, to the extent of almost 35% on the valuation to go with people like DSG Consumer Partners and Verlinvest. Now, Verlinvest is our other big investor who's the private equity sort of arm of the initial family that's behind AB InBev, so the Budweiser guys. So it's about a $2 billion, you know, private equity fund globally. All they do is consumer FMCG CPG brands. Mm-hmm. All DSG Consumer Partners does is consumer brands. All Koval does is consumer brands in FMCG and now online as well, direct to consumer. So I think one of the things we picked up on early is these may not be well-known investors, not that that mattered to us, but they're giving far less of a valuation than some of these sexy investors that are giving. But we realized that these guys are the ones that are actually going to help us build a business. They're actually going to, there's a playbook. There's a lot that they've done. They only understand this. And whereas in the other areas, we may be educating some of those investors. They're just getting into it because they think it's exciting. It's a cool space. And I think that's a decision we took early on. And I think it's the best decision one could have taken. We have some peers that took on the other way around and, you know, they've had struggles. And again, we realized that this is not a bull rush. It's not going to be something that we're going to disrupt. We're going to grow fast, but we're not going to create something in just, you know, 72 hours. Mm-hmm. FMCG at certain point requires sustenance and building value over time. And we need an investor that's going to be with us for the little bit of the longer haul. Again, Fireside, DSG, now even Sauce. I don't know if there's another venture fund out there. So Manu was one of our first investors as well. So we got this amazing ecosystem of all these guys. And I think the reality is not only has the money helped, it's also been just these personalities that have been just the most amazing, not just shareholders and partners, but actually have been like founding team members of the company, you know? And I think that's just been fantastic for us. And honestly, I think once that foundation is built and you're able to capitalize on there, there's more capital out there than there is supply of companies that have reached sort of, you know, a little bit of scale. And I think once you reach that scale, there's a lot of capital out there. The early part is really the tough one, as we all, you know, many of people on here. And I can, and man, I'm happy to play a therapist, any of you who wants to talk about it. We've done it all. There's nothing we haven't done. You know, more than happy to, if you want to reach out. I think now moving to the other side of it, on the strategic sort of question, again, at that sort of our Series C round, we had a couple of options to sort of head towards, and including an amazing option that I was really leaning towards. But you know, what we realized is the same cycle all over again. The reason we chose the partners in the early stage, you know, Series A and earlier, at this sense, you know, who would those partners be? And a lot of people, first of all, I think a lot of people thought, thanks to the ridiculous media, that we sold the company to Danone, but we didn't. They're very minor shareholders. They're purely financial investors, and they have no board seat. So just to clarify that, if anyone has a question, it took a lot of negotiation, but that worked out. But I think with them, it was a very different discussion. It was, okay, we've reached a certain scale. Our current partners have helped us reach that scale. The guys that are very good at building things from scratch, which is what we are. From here on out, as we look at growing bigger and bigger and larger, spreading the footprint, you know, we've got the DNA of entrepreneurship. You know, we've got the leadership that is gunslinging, scrappy, and all of that. But there, you know, in sort of being, you don't have to be disruptive about everything. You know, as we build a business, right? There's you be disruptive about what's your core competence, and you be disruptive about certain things. So, for example, production. You know, we have a great product. Do we really need to look at cutting edge technologies to do something differently and develop it in-house? Absolutely not. That's not our core competence. Our core competence is R&D, coming up with really innovative products. Here's a company that is the world-class best producer of yogurt globally and all types of products like this. You know, so why recreate the wheel when you only have restricted bandwidth anyway? You know, you're getting a consumer base, you're doing the supply chain. A lot of processes and systems, even within the supply chain, we're trying to recreate because now we've built it, and to get efficiencies out of it. Why not just get the best practices and follow them? And I think that's what we realize, is that when we want to pick and choose our battles and we really want to scale, because scaling from 0 to 1, 1 to 10, and 10 to 100 are very different levels of scale. You know, I mentioned this earlier and I was joking, but I actually meant it in all seriousness. I still have no freaking clue what CEO means. I'm an entrepreneur at heart, and I always will be one. I know how to manage. I know how to tell people what to do, and I know how to run around like a madman, which I will continue to do. But now, you know, managing this at scale requires a very different mindset. You know, and I've been getting a lot of advice. It's still very hard for me to do, is structure your day a little bit. You know, have some meetings with the team. My team knows that'll never happen, but I've added a little bit of structure. I've tried, at least. You know, from 100%, we went to 99%. You know, and these are discussions that, again, I think the point I'm trying to allude to is, when you're in the game, who is really going to add value? And I'll be very honest and I'll say this. I think early stage, there's a lot of value creation, with certain funds. Again, I'll repeat, Fireside, Sauce, DSG, they're just the best of the best. Royal Invest, of course, having consumer brand focus. But once you get to a little bit of a later stage, it's just capital at the end of the day, because, you know, you've got a game plan, right? There's a game plan that's working. Your product market fit is out. You're done. Now it's, how do you scale this? And there, I think for us, the conversation became, these guys are going to add a shit ton of value. Of course, it had to be on terms that worked for us. You know, we're not going to give them any rights or board seats or anything. And there was some heavy negotiation. But I can't, I mean, it was just an amazing addition to the family. And they've just been another amazing partner. You know, I don't know how much time I've got left, but, you know, do I have another minute to finish this?
Yeah, please. Okay,
all right. So, again, I can, this was the Gyan side of it. Now, let me give you a clear cut example, you know, which is what people learn from. So we were, when we sort of expanded our product offering, We got it, as we talked about it earlier. So now we've got obviously the no added sugar line. We've got the artisanal line where we've got curd and mishti doi. We've got Greek yogurt smoothies, which are our take on the modern contemporary take on the Indian lassi or the Punjabi lassi, which is thick, of course, infused fruits. And now we're trying to disrupt ghee, which is another narrative we're going on. And now comes our plant-based business, which is coming out pretty soon, on the vegan line. When we started to do all these things, our supply chain got a little interesting, right? And again, this isn't rocket science stuff, very basic stuff, right? So we've got a truck that goes door to door. So listen, hear me out for a second. So you've got a truck that's going to all the shops and you load the truck up from the warehouse, straightforward stuff. Of course, we were one of the first to use some of these apps and we live off of them and how we sort of share data internally, which is also sort of a competence of ours. But then now that you're not just selling Greek yogurt, you've got different types of bottle sizes and different retailers want different types of things. Some retailers may not take only yogurt, will want all the product range. And some retailers will say, we don't want any of the other product range. We just want this, right? How do you sort of manage and maximize time when you reach a store, when you're supplying them? So we were going through this journey and, we had this conversation with the Danone guys. And they're like, it's really interesting because we've got this $250 million operation in Egypt, in Cairo, which is very similar. They call it mom and pop shops, which is the equivalent of our kiranas. In fact, 95% of the business is mom and pop shops and a very similar supply chain. So we're like, really? Okay. And they said, so I said, well, can you put us in touch with their team? We'd love to hear what they've done, right? Especially when they've expanded their range of products. So he calls me back 3 days later. He says, I have a better idea. Why don't you guys just go to Egypt and get on the trucks and just follow the supply chain? I said, would they be cool with that? He said, absolutely. That's all part of this partnership. Why are we partners? So guess what? The four of us go to Cairo for a week. We literally go to their factory at 6 a.m. in the morning. We jump on the truck and we're with them all day on the truck till the end of the day, watching how they do this. And the funny thing is, a crazy story. So, and sorry, cut me off if I'm going too long here, but just giving you an example of why this was exciting and why they're amazing partners. These guys, the guys in Egypt, of course, they were just super intrigued. These crazy Indians have come to town and, they're sitting on the truck with us. And, imagine these truck drivers that have been doing the same thing for 10 years. All of a sudden, you got these four idiots on the truck with you who are like with a magnifying glass. With the magnifying glass trying to figure out what these guys are doing. So long story short, we're on the truck. And these guys are trying to show to us this amazing technology they have, which is this app that they take orders on and things like that, which we've been doing from day one, right? We started the business doing that because that's what we do. We've embraced for startup. Then something very simple, like a small hatch door on the other side of the truck where they take their drinks out of, and the hatch door on the other side of the truck where the yogurts come out of, all of us are like, oh my God, this is the solution. This is the answer. And they're looking at us like, this is such a basic thing that we've designed like 15 years ago. And when you think about it, it's common sense. Why not create three small doors where the three different products can come out of? Mm. But it's easier said than done, when we're scaling up. It's actually the aha moments that are the easy ones. Mm. And these are things that we realize that with the help of these guys, we'll figure it out. We're going to get there. Mm. But, we'll just save a lot of time and energy and effort by not recreating the wheel on many of these things. So I know there's a long answer, but I don't know if that helps sort of sum up the question you had.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome story. And, like you said, I couldn't agree more. I think your early stage investors just add so much value and they save you so much time in terms of, how you think. I think my biggest gain from at least our early stage investors was that they just kept reminding me that you need to think about your market.
Yes.
Because, when you start out, you have these, like, you're all about the product, right? So for you, it's just, my God, this is so cool. Look at my app, look at my web, look at my content. But you kind of need those people to, hold the mirror and tell you to just go back to what's your problem statement, what's your market size, what's your GTM, think about it better. And they save you time. So we're almost out of time. I have a bunch of questions for you that have been coming over from, a bunch of our users and our audience. I'm just going to shoot them at you. If you could address them as quickly as possible, we've got about 10 to go through. So Vaibhav's asking, you weren't from a food background. How did you manage the technical know-how about food development, approvals, formulation, etc.?
Yeah, so Vaibhav, I think one of the best things for doing this was not to be from the food background because we had no preconceived notions. We learned everything the hard way. But the other thing, the quick answer to that is my co-founder is a chef and the initial guy who I invested in the ice cream business with. And I think, of course, he's been a huge part of the story. But that being said, I think, you know, FMCG is very different from being a restaurant chef. So we've learned a lot of things the hard way, and eventually leading to getting someone like Danone in as a strategic and saying, help us with our production. So that's the quick answer to that one.
Jinal C is asking, what's the role that the retailer plays in helping you build your brand?
Yeah, so Jinal, I think that the retailer is the key. You know, I think, so the story is, of course, you know, there's the sort of commercial way of doing things, which is, of course, you know, with modern trade, giving them as much money as they want, and they'd level up to squeeze the crap out of you, putting your product on the shelves in front of everyone. But the reality is, especially on the larger scale, which is the GT shops, the general trade, the Kirana shops, I think just establishing that personal connection and relationship with Dukanwala, it really goes a long way. You know, giving the respect, those guys are also hustlers. And honestly, if they buy into your product and your story, there's no better proponent. There's no better sales you can do than having them buy into what you're doing and be your sort of front end sales rep. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are pushing you on to the consumer. You know, at least that's the way it used to be. Now with D2C, that's a whole different angle, and I can address that later on as well if anyone has a question.
And just a question related to that, right? How do you find the right partners? Because retail in India is also a complex sort of cave unto itself, right? And it isn't as developed as, you know, say the US.
Yeah.
Where, of course, you've got a limited number of modern trade stores. So what is your approach to, you know, finding the right retail partners and any learnings there?
So I think for us, we had a low-hanging fruit in the beginning because it was pretty much whoever has a refrigerator is an audience for us store-wise. If they have a chiller, try to put us in there. And obviously bulk of the chillers tend to be Pepsis and Cokes, which is, you know, thanks to them for allowing us to build our business off their infrastructure. The other thing was, I think we also did a lot of consumer journey mapping. I told you we've got this 200-300 consumer base and it's all over the place. It's not just restricted to a certain audience. It's got a mapping in terms of who the core audience is, a target audience, you know, so, you know, it tends to be sort of a 27 to 32 year old. So we've got a very focused sort of targeting, but we also follow their journey as to, you know, where they live, where they shop from. So while you would think, you know, a fancy store somewhere would be a high revenue generator for us, it's not necessary, it will. And while you would think a Kirana shop in Dahisar would not be a revenue generator for us, it will, it is, because of the audience that lives nearby and the kind of, you know, demographics around it. So we've done a lot of mapping as to the cities, whether it's Bombay, Delhi, wherever, of course. And of course, our product is top 12 metro play, top 5 cities is still 80% of our contribution. That being said, we haven't even tipped the iceberg in these cities. We have so much more just to do in these cities, grow 4 or 5x just in these cities before we get into anything else. But yeah, I think there's a demographic mapping which leads to identification of stores and where we want to be placed.
And a related question someone had asked, people can sort of dismiss you guys as a niche brand, right? But I think the point that you brought up earlier on, which was, are you playing the acquisition game or the retention game?
Yeah.
And you guys have evidently clearly chosen to play the retention game, which actually a lot of, you know, even tech startups like us have had to do because acquisition is getting tough, right? And your channels of acquisition are also limited. Asking you my specific question. When you think about your target addressable market, when you think about how you'll grow or diversify that addressable market, especially in a country like India, where 2/3 of the population is poor, what are your thoughts?
In our game, and very clearly, so we obviously are not catering to the 1.2, 1.3, whatever the latest count billion is. We're not even catering to the 250 million macro Middle East consumer, middle class consumer. If you look at the United States, we just take two states of California and New York. And there are CPG, FMCG brands that do pretty much 100% of their sales in just these two states, 90 to 95%. And these are 200, 300 million, you know, revenue generating dollar brands. And the way we see it is that equivalent and the population of those two states is, you know, 25, 30 million. That is our universe in India. And we are not just confident, we've proven it, we've demonstrated it, that just by tackling, one may call it niche when you're trying to go do a mass volume game. But I think $300 million for me is a nice business. I'm very happy if that's a niche business. I'm okay going down that path. However you want to classify it. But our goal is to capture that 30 million, base. Disney Plus I'm sure you guys have all seen the stats, 8 million already. I mean, that's a great base for us. iPhone users is a great base for us, iOS. And I think just that base is enough for us to build a sizable business. To your point and the point I brought up earlier, we need to make sure we capture this consumer and sell more and more to this consumer as well. You know, just by, so yes, the plan was, do you just take the Greek yogurt and the dehi and go into 9 lakh stores across the country? Maybe not 9 lakhs, but we can probably go up to, you know, 100,000, 120,000. But let's look at that first cohort of 30, 40,000 and see what else we can do with them to build that base. And that's what we've been able to do. Our same store sales growth is how we look at the customer retention or customer is still extremely high. You know, we still clock about 30, 40% a year growth just from that, base. And that's what's been compelling for us.
That's incredible. Yeah. Just last couple of questions, from me, obviously the biggest one is team building, right? What have been the key hires that you've made, which have, you know, totally saved your ass and also, helped add more value to your, to what you and your co-founders know how to do well?
Yeah, saved my ass. The fact that I'm sitting in the basement in Delaware and they're running the company in India, although everyone's running it from home now. So I think that's the fun part. I think the team, obviously, I mean, and I don't think I can say anything else aside from the fact that everyone knows that it makes or breaks you. I think for us, what we've been able to do is attract a very talented set of individuals that just don't connect with us in terms of the functionality of the roles, but also connect with us with regards to the culture. I think we've got, I'm very proud of the culture we have. It's a very, very high on work hard, play hard. There's no, and we established that from the beginning, even with, and of course we brought a very similar culture to what we see in California, a very similar culture to what I've heard a lot about LBB's culture. And I think, for us, what's been fun though, has been adapting that culture, which, the tech world is used to sort of an offline world, which is not used to. It's fulfilling for a lot of, hardcore brick and mortar FMCG folks to come in, get this kind of opportunity to work in this kind of environment. And I think we've been able to unlock a lot of value, especially with, the youth and youngsters that especially the folks that have worked a few years in corporate, would not have a career in companies that traditionally have these type of cultures. But now here's one of a few in the FMCG space that can offer that. I think that's been a huge, huge driver for us. And honestly, I think being a little more specific, I think from a building out perspective, talent perspective, unfortunately, I mean, the advice is it's still you. I'm the only one that can continue doing it, maybe one or two of my co-founders. But honestly, it has to be done by you. I still spend most of my time on that side of it, on talent attraction, talent retention. And really, because if they don't hear from you, why should they work for you or work for the company? They need to... it's you that they're coming on board because of you. And I think you need to sort of be humble about it at the same time, continue that engagement and create the excitement. And I think that's sort of been, our story. The other piece I will say is the only ones that have really killed it for us have been people that we've developed relationships with and over time have come on board. No offense to any placement agency out there that they've all failed so far.
Okay, last question, which is our favorite question at LBB. Is there something are there books you've read, podcasts you've heard, people you love following on like Twitter or wherever else, who all of us can read, hear, follow, etc.?
Yeah, so I'm social media inept. I know people, a lot of my, in fact, my team is really annoyed with me that I don't tweet, I don't Instagram, even though I'm very quick to tell them when we haven't responded to a tweet or responded to an Instagram complaint. They're like, wow, you have time to do that, but you don't want to set up your own profile. I don't do that right now. But I think one book, which is a fantastic book, Jim Collins, Good to Great. I don't know if anyone has talked about that. I think that's a fantastic one. And, I'm a serious believer in that philosophy. Get the right people on the bus, and get the wrong people off. I think that's, and I think the challenge is not knowing right and wrong people. I mean, it's intuitive. Like, yeah, duh, I want the right people on the company. I don't want the wrong people here. It's actually identifying who's right, who's wrong. And that's a very tricky and hard one, right? I think that book, it's an easy, simple read. I think that one is a fantastic book. I think, just simple stuff. I think another favorite of mine is obviously Shoe Dog. The Nike story. I think these two, I would say, would be drivers. I'm not a voracious reader. I love getting insights from people, but I think those would be the two I would select.
Blue Dog is awesome. Yeah. What a freaking story.
Man. Amazing. And again, resilience, right? I mean, you've got a guy who is at the brink of not having a dollar available, but figures that. And it just makes you think sometimes when you think that, oh my God, what am I going through? And I was like, no, wait a second, everyone's gone through this. And I think that's the big, you know, sort of context, you know, sort of reality is that I'm not the only one. You know, sometimes it's almost being a little narcissistic when we think we're the only ones with the problems. It's like, we've all gone through it. Everyone's seen it, you know, so and it's nice to hear that, you know, there's a human touch to all these massive success stories like Nike, right? So it's nice.
Yeah, that was a fantastic book. No, but thank you so much. This was incredible. I know we've eaten into more time than we had anticipated. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me. This is fantastic. And if anyone has any follow-up questions, feel free to email me, check in. Happy to answer. All right. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
All righty. Thanks. Bye-bye.